All right, so welcome everyone to the first CIPL seminar in Lent term, also online. Welcome everyone. I hope you can hear us properly. If you have any problems with the audio or seeing the slides, just perhaps post something in the chat then, or would they post in the question, right? In the Q&A, post something in the Q&A only. Okay, right. So it's a great pleasure to have you guys here, and to especially have Jade Kolokatis here. She's going to be speaking to us on the topic of decolonizing copyright. So that's going to be definitely a very exciting topic. It's something I came across in terms of looking at her work on this about a year ago. And when I read it, I thought like it's a very sort of exciting and, interesting bit to discuss. So I wanted definitely to get Jade to come here and present it to us. I think the topic kind of invites some sort of the underlying idea that IP, perhaps copyright in particular, but perhaps IP more generally, has been part of the sort of colonial enterprise, and we might want to look at that. And we might want to look at ways if and how we can perhaps then decolonize it, but I'll leave that to Jade to discuss. So without further ado, I'll give Jade the floor, 40 minutes roughly. I'll give you a hint, we should be sort of finishing within an hour, so we have some time for question and answers. And with that, over to you, Jade. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Yes, so my name is Jade Kolokatis. I am a lecturer in law at Abate University. I've held that position since January 2017. Before that, I worked in higher education in South Africa, the University of Cape Town, University of the Western Cape, since 2014. My research area is in intellectual property law. I am also a public law lecturer. So I also teach constitutional law and administrative law, which always amazes people. So people will always say to me, well, if your research area is intellectual property law, which is commercial, why are you teaching us about judicial review and the Constitution? And that is something that I'm going to be getting into in this presentation, because I argue that they are not separate things, or at least they ought not to be separate things. So my arguments are quite radical. I accept that I am, as my partner says, a radical woman. I own that. I'm so proud of it. And to sort of soften that blow, I present you with an image of swans, because swans, right? So before we start really annihilating the copyright system, we first need to understand what is the copyright system. And when I say the copyright system, I'm not talking about what does copyright legislation in the UK say versus America versus South Africa versus Hong Kong. I'm talking about copyright at a macro level, right? So we're talking about making big changes, radical changes. You can only make those if you go straight to the source, right? If you go at the macro framework that creates the framework within which national legislatures have to create their laws. So when I'm talking about copyright, I'm talking about, for example, the agreement on trade-related aspects of IP from 1994, the TRIPS agreement, because ain't nobody got time for that long name. The Berne Convention for the Protection of Literary and Artistic Works, originally from 1888, which, fun fact, was also round about the time of Jack the Ripper, perhaps related, perhaps not. And it was amended in 1979. So I'm talking about the macro framework. And what does copyright mean under those frameworks? Now, what copyright generally means, if we want to really break it down, is it's talking about instances where the creator of a work that the law deems worthy of protection, so it's a work that's original, it's fixed, it's met all the substantive requirements for copyright protection, where a creator who has made a work that is deemed worthy of copyright protection is automatically granted exclusive rights in that work. So For example, J.K. Rowling sits down, she writes Harry Potter. This is clearly an original work. It meets all of the requirements for copyright protection. She is automatically bestowed with ownership rights over her creation because it meets all the requirements. And these exclusive rights, these ownership rights, include things such as the right to reproduce the work, the right to translate it, the right to license it, all these proprietary rights, right? So when we want to make Harry Potter into a film, you need J.K. Rowling's permission. You've got to pay her money to do it. If you want to translate Harry Potter, which is written in English, into Spanish, you can't just do that. You need her permission. You've got to pay her to translate it. Right, so these are all the exclusive rights the law automatically gives to the creators of original works. So copyright, at its basic, is about individual rights, right? The right of the creator over their work. And not just any right, but the right to try and monetize it, the right to try and commercialize it, the right to try and get economic or commercial gains off of that work. And we call this the incentivization or rewards theory. So in my research, I've seen it called both things. These seem to be synonyms, incentivization or rewards. And it's the theory that says we want to give creators like J.K. Rowling exclusive ownership rights over their work, because when we do that, it does two things. Firstly, it incentivizes J.K. Rowling, this amazing author who's made this great contribution, to do more of that, right? To spend more time making more books, making more contributions to our culture, to our literary world. And additionally, what it does is it incentivizes other people, third parties, to try and mimic that success. So I see that J.K. Rowling wrote this book, she made millions off it, and I think, well, heck, I'm English too, I can write. So I'm going to sit down, I'm going to think really hard, and I'm going to try to come up with an amazing idea that's also going to be a success. And I dedicate time to doing that. And you do that too. And lots of people we pursue this notion of success, which is rewarded with exclusive ownership rights. And this is very much premised upon a Western capitalistic notion of ownership, right? It is, to use an Americanism, the individual pursuit of happiness, or the individual pursuit of, when we talk about happiness, financial gain, commercial gain, wealth, right? So the individual benefits by making money off the work, and that encourages them to keep doing that same thing, to get more money, to get more wealth. And it incentivizes other people to want to be rich too, to want to make money too, by doing these things. So it's premised upon a very Western capitalist notion of what we mean when we talk about owners and ownership. Now, within this framework, within this macro framework, the international community, the TRIPS Agreement, the Berne Convention, recognizes that coexisting with and sometimes competing against these individual ownership rights lies the public's broader non-commercial interest in accessing these works, right? So, for example, people who are visually impaired have an interest in accessing textbooks, because if they can access textbooks, they can access their right to education. If they can access their right to education, they're able to increase their potential to have good job quality. If they're able to increase their potential to have good job quality, they're more likely to be active citizens of their nation. If they're more likely to be active citizens with fairly decent jobs, they are also more likely to not live in poverty, thereby decreasing global inequality. So it has a lot of these knockoff effects. And the way that the international IP framework recognizes these coexisting, sometimes conflicting public interests that have nothing to do with commercialization, with making a profit, and have nothing to do with the individual owner. They are communal rights. The way that the international framework recognizes this or pays heed to it is by creating a system called limitations and exceptions. So they are expressed by way of limitations to or exceptions from the copyright owner's right. So this may seem a bit complicated. I present you with cheese, right? So cheese is a good way to express this because cheese is amazing. So on the one hand, we have this block of cheese, right? Which is the copyright owner's work. A copyright owner made this cheese. But there is a non-commercial public interest held in accessing this work. For example, visually impaired people have an interest in accessing this book so that they can access education, so that they can access good job qualities, so that we can decrease poverty, because there is a very well-established link between disability and poverty. I've done research into this. Being disabled is one of the key factors, along with race and gender, that will determine whether or not you are likely to die in poverty. So the way that the international framework deals with this is we see that as cutting away, chipping away from the owner's individual rights. So we will say the copyright owner has exclusive rights in their work, but that right is limited insofar as it pertains to blind people accessing your book, because they ought to be able to do it for free. But to use an example, so we see these non-commercial public interests as chipping away from or detracting from copyright ownership. And an example of that is the example I've just provided you with, right? So visually impaired people. This was a very hot topic a few years ago. I was very privileged to be a part of the drafting process for South Africa's implementation of the Marrakesh Treaty. The Marrakesh Treaty is a treaty that facilitates access to published works for people who have visual impairments. In other words, what it says is that if you are blind or visually impaired, you ought to have easier access to books than you currently do, because currently, before this was passed, if you were someone who was visually impaired, you had to pay twice, essentially, to access books, which was a higher cost than someone who's not visually impaired, who can just buy a book and read it. You didn't have to get it translated into Braille or made into an audio book, right? So this is an example of where we see limitations or exceptions chipping away from that ownership right. And this is, again, the discourse that we currently have. So nothing I've said up to now is new or exciting or radical or anything like that until, right? My research and my argument is basically asking, why do we talk about copyright like that? Why is my cheese analogy correct? Why is that the status quo? Right? Why is the norm that if I create a work that meets all the requirements for copyright protection, I automatically have this bundle of ownership rights, exclusive rights over my work? And anybody else who wants to access it, or anybody else who wants to use it, or anybody else who wants to have some sort of benefit from it, non-commercial benefit, the blind people, anybody else, if they want to use it or access it, they need to justify that because they're taking away from my right. And the de facto position is it's my right. You may be able to take that away from me, but you have to justify that. You need to show me, show at an international level, why you deserve that, why you deserve to take away from my right. And my argument is that that seems 50 shades of messed up, right? So what I propose instead is something that is very common in public law. And this is where, again, my public law background comes into play. In public law, right, constitutional law, administrative law, anytime someone, a government official, anybody, wants to exercise power in a way that may or may not negatively impact upon other people, they need to justify that. We have what we call a culture of justification. All powers that are exercised by public authorities, all public powers, have to be justified in order for them to be legitimate. But we don't do that when it comes to intellectual property. We take it for granted that the pursuit of financial gains, economic gains for an individual, is in and of itself justification. It is an end in itself. It is something inherently worthy of protection. Rather than asking, how is that going to benefit the community at large? Not necessarily in a commercial way. How is it going to do good for your community? How is your ownership right over your work going to help realize human rights? How can it be linked to, for example, the United Nations developmental agendas? How can it be linked to access education, to gender equality, to access to medications? How is it going to help further those developmental goals? We don't do that. And I argue that we should do that. There ought to be a public law element introduced into IP. IP has traditionally been seen as a commercial subject. I disagree with that. I don't think IP is a commercial subject. I think Western society has historically deemed it to be a commercial subject, but that is by no means universal. And this brings me to multiple points where I'm now going to seek to persuade you, or at the very least, not necessarily persuade you, but make you think, make you question, right? Keep you awake at night about why things are the way they are. Because we very often, we have this hegemonic discourse about things just are the way that they are. And we don't ever step outside and say, but why is it like that? Why do we do things this way? You know, I studied law. Why did I study law? Why didn't I study tap dancing? Right? Why do I do the things that I do? So firstly, historical context and misrepresentation, right? So this is Moses. He is standing on Mount Sinai. And this beam is the beam of God coming down upon him, giving him a tablet upon which is the Ten Commandments. This is the backbone of Christian religions, right? The Ten Commandments, the 10 sins you cannot do. And we tend to look at the international IP framework, right? The hegemonic discourse, the way IP is framed, in much the same way as we look at these biblical discourses. We don't question them. Nobody says, well, the TRIPS agreement says X, but so what? Why does it say X? Why can't we make it say Y? Nobody questions these things. We take them as being true in and of themselves. And that is deeply problematic. Why is that deeply problematic? Because these conventions and these treaties are supposedly negotiated settlements. They're contracts. You and I enter into a contract. At a macro level, nation states debate and negotiate, and they have this roundtable discussion, and eventually they come to a compromise, and that fair and equal compromise is represented in the contractual terms and obligations known as the Berne Convention and the TRIPS Agreement, but it's not, right? The Berne Convention was originally created in 1888. I probably got that wrong. It's probably 1886, and this is going to go down forever as me getting it wrong. But the Berne Convention was created at a time when Africa wasn't a thing, right? There was no such thing as Africa in the 1800s. Africa consisted of Little Britain Part Two, Little Netherlands, Little Spain. It was just a host of colonized areas. They weren't independent nation states. So these conventions that purport to speak for all these nation states began creation before much of the developed world even existed. How can they possibly represent the developed world's interests when they predate the existence of the developed world? Now, what we could say is, well, for example, the TRIPS Agreement, that's from 1994, right? And by 1994, We can't use that argument anymore, surely. So the TRIPS agreement at the very least is good, has to be good, but it's not, right? And why is it not? It's not because these colonial power struggles play out when it comes to negotiated powers in the creation of these documentations. So when all the nation states come together and they try and negotiate what goes into the TRIPS agreement, you have the developed world who has power and money and investment in the developing world. And they say, we want X. The developed world says they don't. And the developed world says, well, if you don't put X in, we're not going to trade with you anymore. We're not going to give you money anymore. We're not going to send aid to your country anymore. They threaten and they use their power to bully the developing world. And the developing world naturally backs away and says, well, okay, right? Ghana, whose married name is Okadiji, she describes the TRIPS agreement as being a mechanism by which the West seeks to civilize the developing world, right? As being something that the developing world is held hostage with. So on the face of it, it's a negotiated settlement that represents the worlds and interests of all of these different nation states. But if we look at the roundtable discussions, that is not the case. And that continues to exist to this very day, right? My latest article, which I co-wrote with Nkemi Tanyi and Oyeyemi Lawal Orawolo, two colleagues who I've written a lot of papers with, my portion of this article, which is coming out soon, deals with how in South Africa is currently trying to implement an American system of fair use. And America has said that if they do that, they will implement trade sanctions against them, right? America has a system of trade fair use. America has said if South Africa does the same thing, if South Africa implements an American system, America will not trade with them anymore. Why? Because America benefits by South Africa not having that system. American investors make money off of South African work, off of South African labor, off of South African value. They don't want it to be equal. Why would they want it to be equal? Because equal doesn't work for them. And this is so blatant, it's disgusting. And I don't mind going on record saying it's, I think it's disgusting. Right? How can you do that? How can you have a system of fair use and say, it's only for me, it's not for you. You can't use it. That's horrific, right? So this still continues to be the case today. So even in 2023, it doesn't represent the interests of everybody. The developed world is still not treated fairly. And separately as well, I'm putting together a book proposal. It was the suggestion of Ayoyemi, and we're wanting contributions. Graduate students, lecturers, anybody. The topic that we're going to put to Routledge Africa is the protection of cultural expression or folklore in Africa, which lacks fixation, for example, oral expressions, or copyright protection according to Western copyright standards, such as rock art. So it's basically a book where we're going to throw rocks at the international IP framework. It's going to go down really well. Another reason why what I'm saying makes sense, why I hope I can persuade you it makes sense, is because remember I said that there ought to be a public law element to intellectual property. It's not commercialization. It's not intended to be a commercial subject. We can see that looking at these agreements. If we look at the TRIPS agreement, right, we can see that one of their main underlying public policy aims is to assist in the furtherance of developmental objectives. Who needs developmental objectives? The developing world. The TRIPS agreement literally says the purpose of IP is to further developmental goals for the developing world. Nobody talks about that. Find an article where they talk about that. It doesn't exist, right? And when I say an article, I mean find something that where you can find people in authority, legislatures, people at the top, who use that. They don't. It sits there, but we don't talk about it. We don't use it. But the preamble of the agreement establishing the World Trade Organization, which is the body that governs the TRIPS agreement, right? It lists the objectives of raising standards of living and sustainable development. Does it do that? Arguably, no. The preponderance of literature critiques the World Trade Organization of undercutting human rights, labor standards. They call it a race to the bottom, right? So we have all of this expression in these instruments. It looks lovely, but it doesn't actually do anything, right? So this offering I'm making of seeing intellectual property as being part of public law is not that radical. It's only radical because we don't talk about these things. They sit there and they gather the dust. Nobody does anything with them. We don't look at intellectual property and say, well, how is intellectual property going to help in the realization of human rights? How is it going to help in furthering the United Nations developmental objectives for developing worlds? How is intellectual property going to do these things? Because we don't see intellectual property in that way. But historically and arguably at the inception of copyright, that is how copyright was intended. Why do I say this? Because people very often point to the Statute of Anne, which is a UK piece of legislation, copyright legislation from the 1700s, as being the first manifestation of copyright, right? This is the birth of copyright. We want to see what copyright was like at inception. Look at the Statute of Anne. But arguably, we could say that copyright predates the Statute of Anne, maybe not in terms of a written tradition, but certainly in terms of a non-written, predominantly oral tradition. So if we look at cultures, for example, traditional African cultures and tribes and things like that, which I have done, I am from South Africa. I know that I pull off the British accent superbly, but surprise to everybody, I'm not. So if we look at these traditional cultures, we focus on collective rights, and that's what's got a lot of airplay. These traditional cultures have collective rights over medicines and over things like that, which is true. And that should get a lot of airplay. It's important work, great. But we forget that these traditional communities did recognize individual ownership. You have tribes, it's been documented by people who go into these tribes, who do work with them, that they, alongside collective rights, also recognize a system of individual ownership over things like songs and poetry and artwork, right? They recognize that an individual can hold exclusive rights in those works. The difference is that they only recognize that individual as holding those exclusive rights if and when that individual can stand up in front of his tribe, in front of his community, and persuade them that him or her holding these rights is in everybody's benefit. So the onus is on the creator to justify why they should have exclusive rights. It's not a de facto, automatic bestowal of rights. The creator needs to justify it. Yes, you've created this work, very good, thank you. But why should you be the owner of that right? How is you, being the owner of it, going to benefit your community more generally? And if you can show that, you can keep that right. And that doesn't get a lot of airplay. When I was doing my article, I am South African, so there's a lot of things I just know because I lived there and I've lived with these people and I've seen traditional communities and I've learned these things. But if you try and find academic sources, like peer-reviewed, double-blind journals to back this up, which as an academic you have to do, tremendously difficult. It's so difficult because it's not really written about. It's not something that gets a lot of academic traction. So when you're trying to write about it from an academic point of view, it's really difficult to find the sources to justify that. Again, I found a decent amount of sources. That's why my article was published, but nowhere near as many sources as I expected to find, and nowhere near as many sources as there surely should be for something that's, to me, again, as a South African, as someone I spent 28 years of my life in South Africa, I've lived amongst Black people, mixed race people, Muslim, Christian, all these different people. This is something we just know. It's so difficult to find that. So people who say the Statute of Anne is the inception of copyright, I would challenge that, right? Copyright arguably in its original form, always had it, where the owner, right, the creator, had to justify his ownership right. It wasn't a God-given right. It's not as if you're born and you automatically have the right to life, right? They had to justify it. Why is it in everybody's benefit that I have this right? And when we're talking about benefits, we're not just talking about, I'm going to make money. We're talking about, how is it going to help people? How is it going to realize human rights? How is it going to develop the society I live in? How is it going to be for the common good, this non-commercial benefit, which is so difficult for people to understand because we are raised, we are brought up in a system that teaches us that this piece of paper you have that's got the Queen's face on it and it says £5 has value. It doesn't have value, it's a piece of paper. It has value because we've given it value. If we didn't give it value, it's just a piece of paper, right? It's nothing. We all collectively agree it has value, but there's nothing inherently saying it does. And that is the conclusion of my presentation. And I thank you very much for listening to my presentation and giving me this opportunity to present you with my radical woman thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jim.